Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to Free Forum, a world that just might work. I'm going to be speaking today with investigative reporter Jean Guerrero about her book, Hate Monger, Stephen Miller, Donald Trump, and the White Nationalist Agenda. And you can learn more at jeanguerrero.com. That's JeanGuerrero, jeanguerrero.com. Show airs on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA and streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn. Podcasts are available anytime, anywhere on Apple Podcasts, most major podcast sites, and at my site, TerrenceMcNally.net. That's TerrenceMcNally.net. There are 90 days until what has long been called Election Day. But if you're thinking of voting by mail, with the post office now led by a Trump crony and hit hard by the loss of business mail, I think we'd be wise to give ourselves at least a two-week margin. So let's think vote by mail by October 20th and get that word out to all your friends and neighbors. I encourage you to get involved not only with candidate campaigns, but also with efforts to fight voter suppression and assure that all Americans get their right to vote and exercise it, all the more challenging in this time of pandemic and the Trump administration. As we confront that coronavirus pandemic, I encourage you also to do your part by social distancing, wearing a mask in public, and finding ways to help those in your community hurt most by the social isolation and the economic devastation that's now unfolding. And finally, as we continue to make our voices heard against racism and police brutality and for justice and inclusion, please do your part to keep this campaign alive, whether it's showing up on the streets or helping with organizing or fundraising or just taking on the deep reflection or habit building in your personal life and those closest to you. Now to today's conversation. When we think of Trump's administration of incompetence, corruption, and cruelty, Attorney General Bill Barr has been getting a lot of attention lately, and deservedly so. But Barr is a latecomer to the party. He's only been in office since Valentine's Day. By the way, ironic as that might be, Valentine's Day 2019. Stephen Miller, on the other hand, has been with the president since the 2016 campaign. He's officially chief speechwriter, but is widely acknowledged as the architect of the administration's many and consistent anti-immigrant actions and policies, travel bans, family separations, refugees in cages during a pandemic. Another contrast with Barr, the first time Bill Barr was Attorney General under George H.W. Bush, Stephen Miller was in first grade. Who is Stephen Miller? How did he achieve such power so soon? How did the anger and resentment of a young nerd at Santa Monica High in the early 2000s end up twisting the ideals of a nation and fueling the suffering of thousands of vulnerable people that he will never meet? My guest today, Jean Guerrero, attended high school in Southern California the same time Miller did. An investigative reporter, she's written a book that attempts to answer those questions. Jean Guerrero contributes to NPR, PBS NewsHour, and other public media. She won an Emmy for her documentary, America's Wall. Her first book, Crooks, a Cross-Border Memoir, won the Penn Fusion Emerging Writers Prize. And her latest is Hate Monger, Stephen Miller, Donald Trump, and the White Nationalist Agenda. Welcome, Jean Guerrero, to Free Forum, a world that just might work.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Very good. And let me tell listeners, we're recording this conversation Wednesday, August 5th. First of all, how are you doing? You live in Southern California, as I do. We've had a rough time with the pandemic. It seems we try to do all the right things, but it's a tough foe. How are you coping? How are you doing?
I'm doing all right. Thanks for asking. It's just trying to get used to this new world of touring through the internet, really trying to organize my book tour around, you know, conversations like this through the computer. So I've set up a little office space, you know, in my living room. But things are okay. I mean, my family, I've been worried about my mom. She's a doctor, but everyone's doing all right.
Okay. I'm in Long Beach, just outside LA, and you're closer to San Diego, right?
That's right.
And has that, I mean, I don't even know. How have they been doing? How has that area been doing? I know the Riverside and Imperial and so on, very tough times.
Yeah, I mean, it's been kind of up and down here. It's certainly not as bad as Trump has painted this area. He likes to say that because of our proximity to the border, that we've got all these cases spilling across from Tijuana, and that's definitely not the case. I mean, California has just had had far more cases than Baja, although they have, Mexico has been having an increasingly tough time, but it's not a situation where we have cases coming across the border.
And I like listeners to get a feel for the people. We'll take most of the time to talk about the ideas and the work and so on, but how do you see your path to the work you do today? And you can go way back to mentors, turning points, moments of decision, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I've always been interested in the stories of outsiders, outcasts and people kind of on the fringes. I think partly because of my dad. I grew up with a father who, I grew up believing that he had paranoid schizophrenia. He believed that the CIA was after him, and that was the subject of my first book, trying to untangle the mystery around my father. But I've just, as an immigration reporter, I've spent my career telling the stories of marginalized communities, asylum seekers who have traveled a very long way, oftentimes with their children, to escape, death threats, terrible bloodshed in their communities. Also, drawn to right-wing vigilantes to try to understand what's going on in their heads. And I think that's one of the things that drew me to Stephen Miller's story. It was just knowing that for a majority of his life, he really was this fringe sort of outcast. I mean, today he's at the seat of power, so it wouldn't be accurate to say that. But he did grow up in this progressive coastal town surrounded by, a very diverse student population, a lot of celebration of diversity and multiculturalism, and then sort of ended up on the complete opposite end of things, attacking that diversity, attacking bilingualism, attacking multiculturalism. And I really wanted to understand like how somebody goes from an environment like that and ends up being the who Stephen Miller is today. Like even when he was on Capitol Hill, he was a very, it was during a time that the Republican Party was really leaning towards a more moderate approach towards immigration and compromising with Democrats on immigration reform, and Stephen Miller was really pushing things in a more extreme anti-immigrant hardliner direction. And so, but anyway, to tie it back to your question, I think having grown up on the border, just straddling two worlds, straddling multiple identities, my Mexican father, my Puerto Rican mother, but having been born and raised in the United States, I'm just always interested in exploring people sort of on the extremes of reality.
And it just turns out this guy is on the extreme of reality and the extreme of power.
Yeah.
What did you sort of referred to it there, but what did you hope to learn and what did you hope to accomplish?
I first became interested in Stephen Miller while I was covering family separations at the border. I'd been interviewing all of these parents whose children had been taken away from them by US officials under really questionable circumstances. There was one father from El Salvador who had a one-year-old, Mateo. He presented himself legally to ask for asylum at the port of entry here, which is the busiest border crossing in the United States, and asked for asylum because he feared persecution at home, and his one-year-old was taken away from him, and they were separated for 8 months. And I was covering cases like these, and I was listening to the White House talking about how this policy was about law and order. It was about national security and you know, that they were only targeting people who broke the law. But I was on the front lines covering this, and I knew that that wasn't the case, that they were repeatedly separating families who had no criminal record and had broken no laws whatsoever. And so for me, that raised the question, how, I mean, if this isn't about law and order, then what is it about? And that's how I end up turning to Stephen Miller, who's the architect of the family separation policy, as well as so many others, other immigration policies of Trump's. But I mean, I wanted to understand, how does a Jewish American descendant of refugees become the person crafting Trump's harshest rhetoric and harshest policies, targeting people fleeing violence and persecution, people like his own great grandparents?
And what did you hope to accomplish? In other words, there's a lot of work in researching and writing a book.
Yeah. So I really wanted to help Americans understand, through my own, you know, attempt to understand Miller, like, what is actually motivating the immigration policies that we're seeing in the White House. I mean, if it's not about national security, then what is it about? And how can we, you know, properly respond to what is happening? Because you can't really know how to counter a lot of what's happening that you disagree with if you don't understand where it comes from and its origins, and wrap your head around, like, why it's happening. And I felt like, to understand what is happening right now in the White House with immigration, and not just with immigration, but, you know, the entire demonization strategy of the Trump administration is very much rooted in Stephen Miller's influence, demonization of immigrants, demonization of Democrats, demonization of, you know, anyone protesting Trump or white supremacy. And I just felt like it was very important to understand the story of Stephen Miller if you want to understand how to respond to those things that are happening.
You know, one thing, as you said, what is it about if not national security? I think I've always assumed with Trump, he is a racist. These fit with his own beliefs and prejudices. But for him, I always felt it's also it's his base. It's how to inflame his base, and so on. And
Exactly.
though Miller certainly wants Trump to win, because my God. You know, he gets him. He's one of the longest lasting at this point, and we see no signs that he would leave if Trump were reelected. So for him, it's a personal power base. But also, it seems, as you strove to find out, that with Miller, it's more personal. It's not about just inflaming a base. There's something deeper going on.
Exactly.
What is the story? How did Stephen Miller become Stephen Miller? When did his anti-immigrant and white nationalism begin to emerge?
So it goes back to his teenage years, and even a little bit before then. For me, through my reporting, like, I really came to the conclusion that Stephen Miller is a case study in radicalization. It is what happens when someone is exposed to an extremist ideology during a vulnerable period in their life, and ends up completely entangled and inseparable from that ideology, to the point where they're consumed and supplanted by it, and eventually become the most powerful advisor in the White House. But it starts in his childhood, when his father is a real estate investor who was described to me very much as being similar to Donald Trump. He was tangled up in legal disputes and bankruptcies related to his real estate business. His colleagues describe him as very combative. One of the court documents I found describes him as a, quote, "masterpiece of evasion and manipulation." And at one point, Stephen Miller's dad loses a lot of money and because of these disputes, and they're forced to move to a less affluent part of town. And that's when you see Stephen Miller start to express his very conservative, very contrarian viewpoints. And, you know, from my conversations with people in his family and classmates and friends who knew him at this time, it really seemed to people that he was acting out to try to get his father's attention during this time that his father was, you know, so tangled up in the courts. Mm-hmm. And, you know, because at this time, his father was also expressing a lot of, you know, frustration with what he called the ridiculous liberal elite, and just sort of blaming his legal problems on blaming his problems on liberals. And you see Stephen Miller start to do the same thing. I mean, he ends up going to this diverse public high school.
Well, let me jump in for one second, yeah, just because I know you mentioned it, but just to paint the picture a little more clearly for listeners, it is at the point that Miller is 9 years old that Republican California Governor Pete Wilson,
exactly,
was also railing against a migrant invasion. And people forget this, but in 1994, Californians overwhelmingly passed Prop 87, an initiative to ban many migrant children from public schools, and really more extreme than most of what Trump has done. And now, 26 years later, California, you know, is the sort of the poster of diversity and inclusion and so on. But when he was 9, 10 years old, that was not California.
Exactly. That's a really great point. And that's one of the things I found important to show in the book, just because I remember growing up in that environment and how much anti-immigrant hostility there was in California at the time, and how Governor Pete Wilson was blaming all of the state's fiscal problems on what he called the invasion at the border. And there were attacks on, not just, you know, the Proposition 187 with the attacks on social services for children of the undocumented, but there were also attacks on bilingual education and on affirmative action, just really, really a hardcore crackdown on immigrants and sort of scapegoating them for all that was going wrong in California at the time. And Stephen Miller truly is a product of this environment. He internalized that messaging that was coming through, you know, right-wing talk radio that he was listening to. He from a very young age, he was listening to Rush Limbaugh, who broadcast out of the state capitol at the time, and also a talk show host named Larry Elder, who ends up giving him a platform when he's in high school. But he was really listening to these ideas that migrants were to blame for a lot of the problems that were going on in California at the time.
So it works well. His family is hurting. His family has moved to a more diverse neighborhood, and he can find, whether it's in the California Republicans or right wing radio, an explanation for all of what's going on.
Exactly, because you know Limbaugh at the time, he was just, you know, painting white men as the, you know, the aggrieved mm-hmm. parties in all situations. And And Miller had sort of lost his place in line as a privileged white man, which is the way that he identified. He has identified as white throughout his life. You know, he talks about how he Jewish people are a minority, and therefore Jewish holidays are not as important to him as, you know, American holidays.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think like a critical thing that happened is he's echoing these talk show hosts in high school. He's going around telling his classmates, his Mexican classmates, to speak English, to go home if they can't learn the ways of America. He's like going into school board meetings to argue against measures to improve racial equity at the school. So really just like, it struck people as very strange that someone so young mm-hmm. was like so political and so angry. And around that time is when he meets David Horowitz.
Ah, yes. Let's because it really is what I found interesting, and I've known of Horowitz, met him over the years, and been following him a long time, but to see how early they connected and how consistently they have remained connected was quite a revelation. So who is David Horowitz to those who don't know? And then we'll talk about the role he's played in Miller's thinking and his career.
Yeah, so David Horowitz, he's a former Marxist turned conservative writer. He's from New York, now lives in Los Angeles. He runs the David Horowitz Freedom Center and a student advocacy group. And for decades, he has been teaching young conservatives that they need to adopt a very combative stance when it comes to politics, and that it's a matter of survival. That this is something that I feel is really important to emphasize. Like David Horowitz, he indoctrinated Stephen Miller in the idea that America, that the United States was facing an existential threat. In the form of Muslims, in the form of anyone who allies themselves with enemies of the country who always happen to be people of color, and promotes in Stephen Miller this idea that through his hostile rhetoric and attacks on his Latino classmates and later on his Palestinian classmates and so on, that he is saving America, that he is playing a critical role. I have an email where David Horowitz is congratulating Stephen Miller on saving America, like at least for now. And he teaches Stephen Miller, like, because Stephen Miller was reading David Horowitz's writings as a teenager, and David Horowitz teaches him that everything that we hold dear as Americans, freedom, equality, all of these ideals are a product of white men. And so Stephen Miller begins to associate American culture with like being a product of white men. And he then goes on to launder these very racist and white nationalist talking points and policy goals through the language of heritage and the language of economics and the language of national security, which is what makes it so effective and so appealing to a mainstream American audience. It's rooted in his relationship with Horowitz and how Horowitz taught him to talk about issues of race without making them about race.
Mm-hmm. And another thing that you point out, and let me just tell people again, when we say Horowitz was a lefty, I think you mentioned his parents were members of the Communist Party. He worked with the Black Panther Party. And the thing that I remember, he was an editor at Ramparts Magazine, which was one of the early successful radical magazines that had a short-lived but influential career. And that, as with others who make the leap from left-wing radicalism to right-wing radicalism, and there's a number of people we can point to who have done that, it seems they become, even more adamant. But the other thing that you point out is that Horowitz, having been on that side, uses the language, the themes, the memes of civil rights to talk about the aggrieved white.
Exactly. He's able to paint white men as being discriminated against because of their skin color. And he's able to call people of color and liberals racists and oppressors. And he completely inverts the language that is used to talk about the oppression of marginalized communities and uses it to talk about white male conservatives.
Yeah, and Trump, having not mastered all of that, certainly has mastered, and I think this comes natural to him, is that he is the victim, he is the aggrieved, and his base right. is as well. When he says to just recently, you know, why do people approve of Fauci and nobody likes me? It's like to see a president of the United States, you know, state what you normally would think of would come out of a high school sophomore or something, you know, that sense of grievance. And the other thing that Horowitz, I think, infused in Miller was that a different interpretation of free speech. That the mm-hmm. especially when Miller gets to Duke, when he gets out of high school and gets into college.
Yeah, I mean, David Horowitz was, you know, throughout the 90s, he was defending people accused of hate speech, of, you know, of having their free speech rights violated. And so he would use freedom of speech arguments to defend people's rights to say racist and hateful things. But then it's very odd, because then Stephen Miller goes on to use those. Well, first of all, he uses those arguments to get his a regular column at the Duke University newspaper. He's able to appeal to desires for diversity and multiculturalism in order to attack diversity and multiculturalism through his column. And it's, you know, it's just so interesting to see them use these freedom of speech arguments, because then they turn around and they try to silence the opposition. And that's one of the first things that Stephen Miller did when he went to Duke University, is there was a Palestine Solidarity Movement conference being held, and he organized, you know, he told the president of Duke University that they should not be holding this conference, that they were prostituting the campus to terror, and that he was going to tell everyone to stop giving money to Duke University because they had, you know, allowed terrorist recruiting to happen on campus. And again, this goes back to Horowitz, who has long denied Palestinians a right to a national identity. He recently tweeted something like, he tweeted, "There is no Palestine. Mm-hmm. There are no Palestinians." Mm-hmm. And so Stephen Miller really took this to heart. And, you know, I would talk to different administrators at Duke University, and they talk about how it really seemed to them, those who were familiar with David Horowitz and his language, it seemed like Stephen Miller was just parroting and regurgitating Horowitz's talking points and language. And you can see it also in the columns that Stephen Miller would write, you know, starting in high school, but then also in during his column at Duke University, really just sounding exactly like David Horowitz.
Yeah, no, I think Horowitz, you know, in one of his sort of strokes of genius was to choose a lane, and his lane was basically college students, perhaps exactly. remembering, you know, the lefty he was in college, you know, but that he, by focusing on that age group, on that group, Richard Spencer was at yes. Duke. That Richard Spencer, well-known white nationalist, was at Duke the same time as Miller. That's a constituency, an audience that is vulnerable and looking for certainty. And Horowitz has cultivated them. As I said, I've been following this for years. You point out, by the way, this one quote really struck me as fitting so much of what we see from Trump and the ilk. John Burness, who at the time was senior vice president for public affairs and government relations, so dealt with Miller on these questions. And this is the line: he conveyed a sense that he had all the answers and mine were made up.
Exactly. Yeah, it was just this inability to engage in a back and forth with people who disagreed with him. And for me, that's why I see Stephen Miller as such a classic case of indoctrination, because I feel that he became so consumed by this ideology that David Horowitz had introduced him to, and this mission that by perpetuating the ideology, he was protecting America from some grave threat that he ends up incapable of connecting or engaging in real dialogue or even hearing opposing viewpoints.
Let me tell people that you're listening to Freeform, A World That Just Might Work. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with investigative reporter Jean Guerrero about her book, Hate Monger, Stephen Miller, Donald Trump, and the White Nationalist Agenda. And you can learn more at jeanguerrero.com. You spoke a bit about this, about how Horowitz taught Miller the value of demonization. And with that, I'm struck that both Bannon and Horowitz, Steve Bannon I'm talking about, I believe Bannon was left earlier as well and then went right. But both of them basically, I think, even quote Lenin. In that you do not just oppose your opponent, you don't just promote policies, you want to crush and destroy those who oppose you.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, in private correspondence that I obtained for the book, you see David Horowitz sending an actual strategy paper talking about this to Stephen Miller right around the time that the Republican Party was talking about being more inclusive. And, you know, it was right after the 2012 election, and they were realizing that they needed to appeal to a more diverse range of Americans. And they had said this in their autopsy report. But David Horowitz sent Stephen Miller the strategy paper, essentially saying that the Republican Party had to remake itself actually around demonization of their political opponents, and really focus on inciting hostile emotions, particularly fear. He talked about how Obama had used hope to win his elections, and that it was that hope is a strong emotion, but fear is a much more powerful emotion, especially for the Republican Party, and that they needed to focus on inciting fear. And you see Stephen Miller sending this over to Sessions, and you see Sessions, Jeff Sessions, the Alabama senator, really changing his rhetoric around this time and becoming much more combative. And they, you know, that's when they sink the bipartisan immigration reform bill that was in Congress at the time. And eventually, you know, Stephen Miller joins the Trump campaign and is still getting fed explosive material from David Horowitz, including direct talking points that he inserted, that Miller then inserted into Trump's speeches.
Sure. Let me go back to that 2012 moment, because I think you paint the picture, but for America, for our country's relationship with immigrants and immigration, dreamers, all of that, this is a very critical moment, because as you point out, the Republicans, they had a good candidate in 2012. They thought they could mobilize, especially those of them who were racist, thought they could mobilize against Obama. And when they lose, I absolutely remember, you know, the self-analysis that said, wow, the demographics are changing. We've got to appeal to more young people of color, etc. And in fact, what we've seen is it's now 8 years later. We've got the second presidential campaign since then, and they are doing nothing of the sort. But you point out that the Gang of Eight, back when, I mean, it's remarkable to think that the Gang of Eight is bipartisan. That's the four from the, that's the House and the Senate from both sides. And they are working together for comprehensive immigration reform. And given what has just happened in the election, it had a real chance. And Miller didn't just, you know, convince Sessions, but you write that he produces a handbook and mm-hmm. distributes that handbook to the Republicans, and it works. Talk just a bit about that, because that seems to me, as I say, a pivotal moment.
Yeah, so, I mean, Stephen Miller was just very bookish and very immersed in the weeds of immigration policy, and he knew how to take, because of his existing relationships with combative talk show hosts, and because of the new relationships that he was cultivating with combative talk show hosts like Ann Coulter and others, he knew how to insert like very incendiary rhetoric into this folder that he created with ideas for how to actually do the opposite of what the Republican Party was pushing for at the time. He was talking about building a double stacked wall, and he was at the time he was cultivating relationships with these think tanks, Center for Immigration Studies, Federation for American Immigration Reform, and Numbers USA, and polling policies that they wanted and really pushing for them. But one of the reasons that this was really effective is because he was using the demonization of immigrants to push people in the direction of opposing this bill. And another key thing is like he painted anyone who supported this immigration reform bill as being part of a what he called a donor class, a globalist elite that wanted to decimate America through the limitless importation of cheap labor through mass migration, which was misleading, of course, because, you know, part of what the bill intended to do, in addition to increasing border security and increasing resources for Border Patrol, they were trying to legitimize a portion of the immigrant workforce, which would have most likely ended up in requiring that companies pay these people a more fair wage. So it really obviously was not about trying to get cheap labor. But Stephen Miller, you know, was very effective at demonizing, you know, Marco Rubio and just all these Republicans who were trying to work with the Democrats on this bill and painting them as these ridiculous elites who were just out to get some cheap labor.
And then you also point out that it's not just immigrants that upset Stephen Miller. He's also a white nationalist. And that while he is serving with Jeff Sessions, who obviously had built his career to some extent on white nationalism, he begins to, while working as a staffer, he begins to send stuff to Breitbart and right-wing sites and so on. And you've written about, in 2015, so this is the year before he joins the Trump campaign, he promoted a book called The Camp of the Saints, a book from 1973. Tell us about that.
Yeah, for me, that was a huge turning point when I read that book. And I realized that this was a book that Stephen Miller had promoted through Breitbart. It's a white supremacist book written by this French author, Jean Raspail, about the destruction of the white world by a animalistic horde of brown refugees that are described in terribly dehumanizing and degrading terms, you know, as monsters and beasts and teeming ants toiling for the white man's comfort and centipedes and just really repulsive language that is intended to get the reader to feel a sense of disgust towards migrants. The book also explicitly promotes hatred and violence towards non-white people as a method of survival. It is truly a white genocide book. White genocide is a conspiracy theory that white people are being systematically replaced by brown and black people, and that they, you know, this poses an existential threat to Western civilization. And it's what motivates a lot of white terrorism that we see today, like the horrific massacre of Mexican Americans in El Paso last August. And so Stephen Miller, you know, you may already be seeing some of the echoes between the language of this book and the language of David Horowitz, even though David Horowitz, refrains from using
promoting that book. He kind of pushes. He says he's not that far out.
He, David Horowitz says he's not a white nationalist. He says he's colorblind. And I think that Stephen Miller would say the same thing. But when you actually look at what is motivating their rhetoric and their the policies that they're pushing, you begin to realize that that's not the case. I mean, Stephen Miller, he from a very young age was being exposed to white supremacist websites, you know, American Renaissance, mm-hmm. which David Horowitz tells me that he thinks he introduced Miller to. Mm-hmm. This idea, this website is constantly pumping out misleading statistics about black and brown crime, trying to paint black and brown people as innately more violent or dangerous than white people. And Stephen Miller, you know, he's exposed to this very young and starts to become radicalized. And then, but while he's working for Sessions, like going back to that critical moment in 2012 and early 2013, when the Republican Party was trying to remake itself as more diverse, Stephen Miller was looking explicitly at this analysis that was done by Sean Trendy for Real Clear Politics about the missing white voter. And Trendy wasn't saying that the Republican Party needed to appeal more to white voters, but he was pointing out that there had been a large portion of white voters who had sat out the election in 2012. Mm. And so Stephen Miller starts to, deliberately try to appeal to these white voters. So, you know, he's reading white nationalist literature, he's reading white supremacist literature, he's promoting this literature through the right-wing blog Breitbart, telling bloggers to write stories about this content. And he is, also like when he joins the Trump campaign, he begins to take policies directly from the think tanks that I mentioned, which were created in part by John Tanton, who was a eugenicist who believed in population control for non-white people, who believed in race-based pseudoscience about the genetic superiority of whites. And he helped create these think tanks in order to make his white supremacist policy goals palatable to the mainstream. And these are the think tanks that Stephen Miller turned to craft immigration policy for Trump. Right. And it's also important to mention that Tanton, this eugenicist, he is also behind the English language translation of Camp of the Saints, which is this horrific book mm-hmm. that I just described. Mm-hmm. And Tanton was also a big fan of David Horowitz. So like connecting all these dots, it gets a little bit confusing, but I think it's very important to show the tree of life here, which is part of what I try to do in the book, is just connect the dots between these figures. You know, people like Horowitz, people like Miller, they say that they're not white nationalists, but you look and you see how closely they are tied to that movement and how Stephen Miller is directly pulling from that movement in order to affect policies in the White House.
I'm curious, you mentioned how one of the claims and fears in Camp of the Saints and that sort of thinking is that the whites are to be replaced. Is that where the "You Will Not Replace Us" chant in Charlottesville comes?
Exactly. So the great replacement theory, it comes from this idea of white genocide. There's a lot of fear around birth rates in mm-hmm. brown and black communities, and just this idea that white people are being replaced, which to me is part of the reason that Stephen Miller's childhood is so fascinating, because he grew up at a time in California where whites became a minority mm-hmm. for the first time. And there was all of this white fear and white backlash tied to that, where people thought, you know, there were protest signs about how California was turning into the third world, and how people thought that whites becoming a minority in California was going to mean the end of civilization in California, which is obviously not what ended up happening. But those same fears that were, you know, spreading in California at the time and that Stephen Miller was internalizing as a child are what we're now seeing on a macro level nationally.
Right, right. And as you point out, in that 2012 campaign, Mitt Romney was not aiming his campaign at those missing white voters, those exactly. aggrieved white voters, those ones who George Packer writes about in The Unwinding, and Nick Kristoff and Cheryl Wu Dunn write about in Tightrope, and that Case and Deaton write about the deaths of despair, and Arlie Hochschild writes about in Strangers in Their Own Land, and Mitt Romney just was not their candidate, and Miller and his ilk turn the party to pursue that aggrievement. Let me exactly. point out that one of the things you say that Miller's working for Sessions. Sessions is one of the earliest supporters of the Trump campaign and thus becomes attorney general. But Miller wants to get on the campaign. He's critical in obtaining Border Patrol and ICE union endorsements for Trump during the 2016 campaign, which is what sort of yes. gets him his ticket to the White House. Talk about that for
exactly.
a sec.
Yeah, Stephen Miller, he really cements his status as a key player on the Trump team when, you know, because early on, there were a lot of immigration hardliners who kind of rolled their eyes at Donald Trump. Like, even though he was talking about building a great wall at the border, a lot of people who had been following the immigration issue closely for a long time knew that the wall, you know, we already have hundreds of barriers and that it hasn't really done anything to decrease overall immigration flows. It has simply rerouted them into other parts of the country. And so they didn't really take Trump's campaign seriously until Stephen Miller was on board. And Stephen Miller uses his connections with the Border Patrol and ICE unions, which he had developed while he was derailing the immigration reform bill in 2014. To obtain their endorsements. And he obtains their endorsements by promising them a direct line to the White House and promising that they're going to have a regular role in shaping immigration policy. And what Border Patrol wants is not necessarily the wall. What they're more focused on is how do we decrease family migration to the United States? Because they had felt very disillusioned and disappointed in what was happening at the border ever since the unaccompanied minor crisis in 2014, where all of a sudden you saw, you know, an overwhelming number of children and families coming seeking asylum. And Border Patrol, this sort of impinged on their perceived roles as warriors and vanguards.
Harder for them to appear like the good guy
exactly.
if it isn't young, lean men who are leaving their villages and coming up here, but families, what, women and children.
Exactly. And so Stephen Miller spoke to them about what they wanted and how they wanted a greater capacity to keep people locked up, and they wanted to deter family migration in whatever way possible, which is what we later saw with the family separation practice. And they wanted to end catch and release, which is the practice of allowing asylum seekers who prove a credible fear to be released on parole while they await their court hearing. So just really transforming the asylum system at the U.S.-Mexico border. And this is how Stephen Miller is able to get the union endorsements for Trump, and people really start to take Trump seriously as far as like his law and order credentials.
I had taken some notes, but we're not going to have time to talk about it. But I just want to mention to people, since we're talking about the border and the Border Patrol, I interviewed earlier this year Greg Grandin on his book, The End of the Myth, From the Frontier to the Border Wall in the Mind of America. And if what we're talking about here is of interest to you, I recommend that book, in which he says that for all of America's history, the frontier has been our big myth, and that all of a sudden you've got this propagation of a wall instead of a frontier, and what does that mean? And his story of the Border Patrol and white supremacy and so on is fascinating and worth reading. One of the things that you point out is that it helps that he got those endorsements, but that once in the White House, Miller has a special relationship with Trump. That Miller, probably learning both from Trump and from Horowitz, doesn't want to deal with the norms and the bureaucracies, even within a Trump White House, and is constantly looking for ways to get around them. And by cultivating his special relationship with Trump, he's able to do so, get things okayed, published, spoken without the normal kind of vetting that would happen throughout the departments and so on. What's the source of that special relationship in your view?
Yeah, for me, Stephen Miller gets Trump emotionally, spiritually, and psychologically. And it really goes back to the fact that Stephen Miller grew up with a father who, according to people who knew him, was very similar to Trump. I think they have, similar notions of what it means to be a man. I think that Trump really trusts Miller because Miller is his only advisor who consistently pushes him in the harshest and most aggressive direction. And Trump loves that because whenever he has followed the advice of advisors who push him in a more moderate direction, he ends up getting pummeled and ridiculed by his base as weak. And Trump doesn't like to be seen as weak. And so he sees Miller as sort of a fellow killer, just a person who's got a very aggressive mentality, and he Miller appeals to Trump's harshest and I believe most ingrained impulses.
And then
And
in a White House where people come and go and are fired and resign, his closeness and his length of service, you say, other officials, obviously with much more experience and of, a generation older in cases, are afraid to question or challenge him.
Yeah, Miller is always invoking the president and channeling the president. And people tell me that they're always afraid to question Miller because of that, because he was always invoking Trump's desires and Trump's name. And so for them, it felt like if we're challenging Miller, it's like we're challenging the president. But numerous White House officials that I spoke with and national security experts tell me that this strategy that Miller had of bypassing hierarchies and ignoring regular operating procedure ended up making Americans much more vulnerable to homeland security threats, such as, domestic terrorism and even the pandemic that we're seeing today, because he really narrowed the focus of the Department of Homeland Security to from its very broad mandate to protect Americans from all threats into something that was laser focused on the civil immigration issue and on fighting family migration and keeping out asylum seekers and refugees.
But
And that's a
as you point out, has been expanded now to this is the Department of Homeland Security we're talking about, as a political weapon for a white nationalist agenda, beyond again, beyond just immigration, but against people of color.
Exactly. You see Trump now talking about Black Lives Matter as a symbol of hate, and you see him really expanding his attacks from immigrants to also anyone who is allied with the Black Lives Matter movement and, the anti-racist protesters who people protesting white supremacy, anyone who really speaks out against white male supremacy is now becoming a target of the Trump administration. And I believe that really goes back to Stephen Miller and his ideology and his impact on the Trump
Yeah, you
administration.
point out acting DHS Secretary Chad Wolf has adopted his language, referring to lawless mobs. Trump talks in Tulsa about far left fascism, well, at Rushmore, and then left wing mobs in Tulsa. And so Miller is really, as you point out, because he's the one who pushes Trump to be even tougher, it's sort of like Trump now channels Miller when Trump's at his worst.
Exactly. I mean, you hear Trump repeatedly use the phrase agitators, anarchists, and agitators to describe the anti-racist protesters. And it was so eerie to me to see that because it comes straight from the Camp of the Saints book that Stephen Miller promoted. It's, characterizes all anti-racists and allies of people of color as agitators and anarchists and mobs of people who are trying to destroy America. It's the parallels are so eerie and so important to understand. And but yeah, it appears that Trump has really he is leaning more and more on Stephen Miller during this time of crisis because he knows that he cannot, he can't rely on a strong economy for re-election. He can't talk about how well he responded to the coronavirus, because everybody knows that's been a complete disaster. And so he's really relying on Stephen Miller's politics of division and creating distractions through the vilification of other people in order to hopefully win.
Right. And of course, one of Miller's first big wins was the inaugural speech describing carnage in America. And, mm-hmm. and we didn't actually hear that much about that for a while. And obviously that is what we hear now in the re-election campaign, is that same thing, mobs, carnage, etc.
Exactly.
If I give you a minute, what's the message? What should people do besides vote, 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 and make sure everyone else votes? What's your message? What should people think about, look at? Where can they learn more? What can they do? That sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just so important. Like, if you want to understand this era of polarization that we're living in America today, you need to understand the story of Stephen Miller. This is not just about immigration. This is about the pitting Democrats and Republicans against each other, pitting people of color and white people against each other. All of this comes down to Stephen Miller. And I think what's going to happen in November is going to really depend on the extent to which people start to wake up to how their emotions are deliberately being played against one another, and how, what is actually motivating this administration is white supremacy. And we need to start feeling a lot more emboldened in our ability to talk about it in that way. I feel like, our institutions, even progressive institutions, have been really reluctant, in journalism, for example, to use words like racist to describe, our president, because we don't know what's in people's hearts. And, I can't tell you what is in Stephen Miller's heart, but what I can tell you, and what I do tell you in the book, is Stephen Miller is fluent in the language of hatred. So I don't know if he's got hate in his heart, but he's absolutely fluent in the language of hatred. And that is the emotion that he is inciting to rally people around performatively cruel policies and divisive rhetoric. And you need to understand it in order to respond to it appropriately.
Very good. And what has always struck me, and I looked at it at the moment the pandemic really took hold, was that this is a time, this kind of crisis for all of America means America needs to come together. And I knew we had a president and a speechwriter who, that was the last thing they wanted, was for people to come together, that every move they've made has been to divide us. So again, the book is Hate Monger, Stephen Miller, Donald Trump and the White Nationalist Agenda. The website is jeanguerrero.com. That's JeanGuerrero, jeanguerrero.com. For this conversation and many other interviews and articles, to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net, terrencemcnally.net, or a world that just might work, all one word, a world that just might work.com, to the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, usually 8 or 10 articles to flesh out the conversation, provide context, sign up at my site, or email me at temcnally, temcnally, at mac.com, mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast on Apple Podcasts, iTunes, and at most major podcast sites. You'll find years of podcasts at my site and at a lot of those others. Michael Lewis, Jeremy Scahill, Naomi Klein, Robert Reich, Van Jones, Connie Rice, Greg Boyle. You can also follow me on Twitter, at McNally Terrence. Thanks to G. Lee in production, George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices, and most of all, you, my listeners, please share this podcast widely. And finally, thank you, Jean Guerrero. Keep up your good work.
Thank you so much, Terrence. Great to be here.